I'm Dr. Chris Busby. I was a visiting professor at the University of Ulster for some years. My research interest has mainly been the health effects of ionizing radiation. Ionizing radiation being the sort of stuff you get from Chernobyl and Fukushima and X-rays and so forth. And over the 30 years that I've done this research, I have discovered all sorts of things, but mainly what I've discovered is that the current radiation risk model, that's the one that underpins the laws relating to radiation exposure of members of the public, are in error by an enormous amount for internal radiation. That's the sort of stuff that you inhale or you ingest. The radionuclides like plutonium and cesium-137 and all of these things that we now know about, that never existed on Earth prior to 1945 when they dropped the first atomic bomb. And in particular, what I've discovered is that the weapons fallout, that's the nuclear testing that was done between 1952 and 63 in the atmosphere all over the world, it got into the food chain and has caused the cancer epidemic, which began in about 1980. And is still increasing. So now we have like a four. We're told that one in two people will have cancer in their lifetime. And this is not because people are getting older, because the age-specific rate is going up. And now children, young people are getting cancer, which was unheard of 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so that's so as a result of this, and as a result of my increasing credibility, I have been able to publish this stuff in the peer review literature, but it's being excluded. It is it, I have been sort of squeezed out of public consciousness or media consciousness more or less since Fukushima. And so, if you try to find me on the internet, you have some difficulty because it's increasingly clear that for instance, search engines like Google are actively excluding my name and my work. As you can find out, as I did find out from various experiments I carried out.
Chris, the not long after Fukushima, there are reasons why some people don't take your work seriously, and that is largely or fund your work, and that is largely due to a certain individual by the name of George Monbiot, who's an environmentalist and a Guardian columnist, who basically has, he says anyway, exposed you as a quack.
Yes. Well, my response to Monbiot, to the operation that Monbiot has developed, is that Monbiot is in the pay of the people who are trying to exclude this evidence from public consciousness. I do believe that. I think that he is one of the main people, and another one is Mark Lynas, and they're increasingly active at the moment. You, at the very instant in trying to push nuclear as some kind of magical solution to all the problems associated with climate change.
Yeah, well, hang on, because how would you actually, tackle Monbiot's criticisms of you head on, specific criticisms?
Well, he had two main criticisms. The first one was that I was selling pills to the Japanese public, to protect against radiation, and he got a couple of tame scientists from the nuclear industry, in particular that woman Jerry Thomas, to say that what I was saying was nonsense. In fact, so I was selling cal I wasn't selling anything, incidentally, but I did advise some people who wanted to head off the problems associated with the contamination from Fukushima, and I said that the best thing they could do was to take calcium tablets, and so a number of firms started selling calcium tablets, and they put my name on, Dr. Busby's calcium tablets, but I had nothing to do with any of them, and I didn't get any money from any of them. They just decided to do it. I told Monbiot this incidentally, but he didn't report this in his article. And the second thing, which was wrong, of course, he talked to me, and I told him this, and he didn't report what I said. And then later on, I complained to the Press Complaints Commission, but they did nothing at all. The other thing he attacked me over was a study that I'd done showing that there were high levels of child leukemia along the North Wales coast. And this was associated with contamination from Sellafield. And when I did that, I was attacked by the Welsh Cancer Intelligence Agency. But in the end, it turned out the Welsh Cancer Intelligence Agency attack was completely misapplied. It was just wrong. It was dishonest. And they had to apologize, which they did apologize. But of course, none of this gets into the media, because the media is controlled by the people who want to push nuclear and have nuclear weapons and nuclear bombs, what I would call the nuclear military complex, what everybody has called the nuclear military complex. And these people are very powerful. And they still own, if you like, or direct, increasingly, the media circus which we see, you know, the false truth about all of the things that we read on the internet, and the exclusion of Chris Busby in particular.
Okay, what about the general landscape in nuclear research and legislation? Because you've got government regulators and you've also got the industry itself, but it seems that you're sort of one beyond that. Are you the only person that's ever been doing this, or is there a whole kind of tradition of scientists, old school scientists?
Yeah, there is a tradition of scientists, and some very eminent ones too, Alexei Yablokov and Alice Stewart, who was the woman who in England who first discovered that child X-rays, obstetric X-rays, cause child leukemia. And Yablokov has dealt with the issue of the health fallout of the Chernobyl accident, and shown that more than 1 million people will have died as a result of cancer caused by the fallout from the Chernobyl accident, and so forth. There have been a lot of these people, but most of them are dead now. So I'm pretty much the last of the Mohicans, because I was younger than these people. I mean, Yablokov was 82, Alice Stewart was 94 when she died, I think. Rosalie Bertell, another one who wrote a book called No Immediate Danger, she also died several, you know, 20, maybe 20 years ago. Alex, the other chap, Ernest Sternglass, who pointed out that there were all these children dying as a result of the weapons fallout, he died. So they're all dead. And of course, young people are not interested in going into this area. There's no money in it. In fact, it's the opposite. You get attacked all the time. You get pulled down. If you're in a university, you get kicked out. I got kicked out of the University of Ulster because of my writings about depleted uranium. They didn't like it, because universities have to survive, so they have to get money from funders and so forth. They don't want some guy like me coming along and bringing their university, as they would see it, into disrepute, or at least blocking funding from people who have money. And people who have money don't really want to put money into someone like me, who's doing the research that shows that everybody is dying. Nobody wants to know that they're all dying of cancer because of radiation. They all want to think that the world is a great place and everything is fine. And someone like me is you know, very negative in this regard. So nobody wants to fund me. I mean, I was funded by the Joseph Rowntree Charitable Trust for many, many years. But once Monbiot came along and said that I was a false scientist and a phony scientist and all this stuff, they all dropped me, you know, very quickly. So I never got any more funding after about 2011, after Fukushima and after the attack by Monbiot. So I kept going as a result of working as a consultant. I got a bit of money as a consultant in America with a very famous lawyer called Stuart Smith. And he used to fund the European Committee on Radiation Risk, which I set up with my friends in the Green Party in 1998. So he used to drop a bit of money our way, enable us to function. But now he's dead. Last year he died suddenly and rather unexpectedly, in the middle of an attempt that we were making, that he was funding, to take on this risk model at the level of the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, which you can use in court on the basis of saying that their risk model was created dishonestly. It was created arbitrarily and capriciously. That's the wording. But anyway, you know, he was just ready to do that, and we were doing all the work on it, and then suddenly he dies. I have to say that a lot of people that have been, you know, implicitly, I suppose, anti-nuclear, do tend to suddenly die.
Can you say something about this risk model in a nutshell?
Yes, the risk model is based on Hiroshima. It's based on the health consequences of the Hiroshima exposures at the time of the bomb. Epidemiologists working for the Americans, what they did is they selected about 80,000 people And they followed them through their life. It's called the lifespan study, to see how many cancers there were. And they related that to the amount of dose that these people received when the bomb went off. So it goes, the big flash, everybody gets gamma rays, and these gamma rays are from the outside of the body. So they come into the body from the outside, and you get a sort of average amount of energy over the whole body. And on the basis of the quantity called dose, which they invented in order to measure the exposure, on the basis of that, they then draw a line between zero dose and the various doses that people got from different, standing at different distances from the detonation when it happened. So that's the Hiroshima study, and the risk model is basically based on that. But of course, but the problem is that in the last 15 years, it's become increasingly clear that the dose that they got has got nothing at all to do with the amount of cancers. The amount of cancers that have been appearing are a consequence of the internal radiation that they got from inhaling radioactive particles from when the bomb exploded. When the bomb exploded, only 95% of the bomb didn't fission. It didn't turn into a nuclear explosion. It just sort of blew apart, and all this stuff rained down in what's called the black rain. And people exposed to the black rain all had high levels of cancer, even if they were 5 kilometers away from the detonation and received zero dose. And so a court case was taken quite recently, 2021, 22, I think, in Japan, in which the Japanese government conceded that. They said, yes, these people who were in the black rain areas, even 5 kilometers away, if they got cancer, their cancer, we agree, was caused by their exposure. Well, of course, there was no exposure. So they got exposed to basically uranium-234 and uranium-235, 238 particles, these tiny, tiny particles, which they inhale, and then they get into the lymphatic system, and they cause enormous immediate dose to the locality of the particle, and that results in the cancer. So that's basically what's wrong with the risk model. The risk model is still based on the idea that you're standing there and somebody gives you an X-ray, and the amount of energy you absorb is proportional to the amount of health consequence you will have, whereas in fact it's the cells that get the dose. So if you have a particle inside you irradiating, what, 5 or 6 or 7 or 80 cells, you know, close to the particle, the actual dose to the cells is enormously high. It's 10,000 times higher than the average dose over the whole organ. So that's basically the problem. That's the dishonesty, and that's what is at the root of these consequences that I'm drawing attention to in these 5 or 6 papers that I've written in the peer review literature in the last 5 years.
So is there any way of getting these particles out of the body? Can the body do it itself with a bit of help?
Generally, no, is the answer to that. And this is the horror. I mean, in Fukushima, where they used depleted uranium weapons, I was asked this because they were then getting all these cancers in, not Fukushima, sorry, Fallujah in Iraq, where the Americans used depleted uranium weapons, which produced the same particles as the bombs. And the people there asked me, you know, when will this awful plague of congenital malformation, birth defects, cancers, when will it end? And I had to say the answer is probably not for a very, very long time, and certainly not in the lifetime of the people that inhaled these things. I mean, experiments that were done with mice show that the half-life of these particles in the body of the mouse is about 15 years. Which means that, you know, they're more or less with you for your lifespan. Once this is what the people are finding who fought out there, the Gulf War veterans. They're finding that they suffer this Gulf War illness, and it just goes on and on and on, and their children have congenital malformations. There have been lots of papers on this.
So whereabouts in the UK, whereabouts in the world are the hotspots for this? Because you would expect where there's more of these radionuclides, I think you called them, that there will be more cancer.
Well, that in theory is true, but the problem is where you have very high levels of these things, you don't get cancer, and the reason is because you die. Because these things don't just cause cancer; they irradiate the body, and they cause you to lose various years of your life. You know, so people who are exposed to these things, although they do get an increased level of cancer, what happens is they get an increased level of deaths from all sorts of other things too, sort of like a uniform across the board premature aging. And we see this in Belarus, where there was a lot of radioactivity from these particles and so forth from Chernobyl. So the death rate in Belarus has absolutely collapsed immediately after 1986, after the Yuri Bandashevsky, who is a colleague of mine, who they jailed for saying all of this stuff. You know, they put him away in Siberia, and eventually he got out. So, but he wrote some books which he sent to me right back at the beginning, in which he showed that children were getting heart attacks as a result of this stuff. So, of course, if you have a heart attack as a child and you die, you don't get cancer. And if you die roundabout few years after Chernobyl, that the average life expectancy of males in Belarus in those areas was about 45. There are plenty of evidence of this. So the point is, cancer is a disease that you get when you're old, when you're 60 and 70 and 80. But if you die when you're 45, clearly you don't get cancer. So if you're just looking at the average rate of cancer in a population, you don't necessarily get as much of an increase as you might expect to get if you just applied the rule of proportional cancer relative to the proportional dose. A lot of people die, and a lot of children die.
Now, I know you've, staying with Eastern Europe, you've been having a look at radiation levels since the beginning of the war in Ukraine.
Yes, that's right. I was interested in 2006 about the radiation levels in England, which are measured by the Atomic Weapons Authority in Aldermaston. In the 1990s, there was a big leukemia cluster, in the 80s anyway, and in the 90s they looked at it, a leukemia cluster around the atomic weapons establishment at Aldermaston and Burfield, two sites near Reading. And there was a big childhood leukemia cluster there. I mean, I wrote about it and published something about it in the British Medical Journal in 96.
Sorry to interrupt you, but what do they do in those places?
They make the atomic bombs, and they make the nuclear weapons, and they make the depleted, I think they make the depleted uranium, but they certainly release an awful lot of uranium and plutonium. So that's where they constructed and developed the original nuclear weapons that were used at Christmas Island. And I do a lot of work with the nuclear test veterans on this issue, because those people are all getting cancer, and they've all got cancer. And so I've done a lot of court cases for those people. But atomic weapons establishment was at Aldermaston releases plutonium and uranium particles, and so they were forced in the 90s to set up filters at the plants themselves, but also 15 miles away from the plants, so that they could check to see whether any increases occurring were not global. So, you know, the idea was that if you get an increase of X at Aldermaston plant, and the same increase occurs, say, at Tilehurst or Basingstoke or whatever, where they used to have a filter. These filters pump air through a big filter paper, and then every 2 weeks they take the filter paper and they measure the amount of uranium on it or the amount of plutonium. Anyway, so in 2006 I had a look at those to see whether stuff was coming from the 2003 American war in the, you know, second Gulf War, and it was. And so that got into the Sunday Times, I think. So we had a big article in the Sunday Times on that, with a picture of the graph. So I thought recently, let's see what's happening in Ukraine, you know, because the point is there are all tank battles in Ukraine. And as the Americans showed in the Saddam War, depleted uranium is what kills tanks. Tank battles are impossible if you use depleted uranium. I went out to Iraq with Al Jazeera, and I looked at all the corpses of the tanks that had been hit by depleted uranium, and I measured the depleted uranium, and also in Kosovo too. I did that with Nippon Television. So I know all about the use of those weapons to kill tanks. They're absolutely deadly efficient. So I thought it was unlikely that they weren't being used in Ukraine. So I did a Freedom of Information request to the Atomic Weapons Establishment, and they sent me all the numbers, and I looked at them. I plotted them all the different sites. There's nine air filters at different places around them. I plotted them all on one graph, and lo and behold, as soon as the war began, in February 2022, up it went. And so if you it really quite large increases in uranium in the filters. So if you compare the war period with the non-war period, that would be from 2018 to 2022. That's quite a long period of time. So you get a big average there. And if you compare the average from the next 6 months, you can see that there's a statistically significant doubling in uranium in the air filters at Aldermaster. I mean, this is bad, because this means that the uranium in the air filters, of course, most of the uranium in the air filters is natural. But if you've got a sudden doubling during the war, it means that the amount that is suddenly appearing in those filters is coming from Ukraine, from somebody's use of uranium in Ukraine.
In its actual toxic effects and quantities, how does this compare to something like Chernobyl?
It's a different sort of thing. It's much more comparable to Gulf War syndrome and to the effects of Gulf War. Chernobyl
sounds to me like a kind of radioactive, very, very thin, difficult to detect radioactive cloud that's heading our way from Ukraine.
It's impossible, in fact, because these uranium particles are alpha, what's called alpha emitters. There are three kinds of radiation, basically. There's gamma emissions, gamma radiation, which penetrates the body and goes long distance. You can measure it, you know, 1, 2, 3 meters away with a Geiger counter. Or there's these beta particles, which are basically electrons, which have a range in air of about, well, less than a meter. And you have alpha particles, which are the really nasty ones. They're little short-range things, helium nuclei, doubly charged helium nuclei. And once they get inside the body, once a particle gets inside the body and starts firing these things out, it totally smashes cells to pieces. They're the most dangerous sort of internal radiation, and they cannot be measured with Geiger counters. And so all these detectors they have all over Europe to look at the radiation from gamma emitters, like, you know, because they set these things up in order to ensure that there was an early warning in case there was another nuclear explosion at some nuclear plant. But they're completely useless when it comes to looking at alpha emitters. You have to have a special type of detector for that. And so these things are basically invisible. Nobody's looking for them. And there are no sites in Europe where they detect this stuff. Luckily for us, or sort of interestingly for us, if you like, is that there's this one site in Aldermaston, probably one of the few sites in the whole of Europe, that continuously monitors for these alpha emitters, and then now it's found them. There they are.
Who do you think is likely to be firing these depleted uranium shells? And maybe you could say a little bit about why they are now de rigueur for tank battles, because, you know, is it different to other sorts of shells that are being fired? And also, you know, is it the Russians? Is it the NATO side? Obviously, that would be the Brits and others supplying the Ukrainians with these anti-tank shells.
Yes, well, I think that probably is the case, but I mean, I can't say is the answer, the real answer. I mean, we don't know. The Russians say they don't use depleted uranium, and they also get very shirty about the possibility that the Americans are going to send these Bradley fighting vehicles, which everybody agrees do use depleted uranium. But the real fact is, to people who are behind the scenes and know about these things, is that you cannot fight tank warfare without depleted uranium. There's only one possible substitute for it, and that's tungsten. Tungsten is very expensive, and tungsten is not as efficient. The reason why depleted uranium bullets are efficient is, well, apart from the fact that they're more or less free, because this is nuclear waste, and otherwise they would have to pay to get rid of it. The reason why it's so good is because it's what's called pyrophoric. So when it hits a target, and this is not an explosive, this is just a lump of metal. I've picked these things up. They're about the size of a cigar, the ones from the A-10. But you get much bigger ones that they fire from tanks, which are the 155-millimeter caliber. But the rod itself, the thing that's called the penetrator, is actually quite narrow. It's just like a metal rod that's in the middle of a plastic, what's called sabot, like a plastic tube. And they shoot the thing, and when it hits the tank, when it hits the armor, it catches fire. And the temperature is huge. It's like 3,000, 5,000 degrees. And it just burns its way through, producing all this powder. And once it gets into the tank, of course, all the fire just incinerates anybody inside the tank, and it blows the lid of the tank off. And so when you see these tank graveyards down in Kuwait, down on the battleground side, all lying about there, they've all had their top blown off. It's quite remarkable. The top just gets blown off by the pressure from the depleted uranium explosion inside the tank. So I think it's inconceivable that the weapons probably. I have to say the missiles, the hand-fired missiles that are anti-tank missiles use shaped charges, and these shaped charges they say are copper. But actually, I don't think they're copper. I think they're probably uranium. And I said this a lot in the past. And they're absolutely deadly. So I mean, why would anyone use something that isn't deadly if you're trying to destroy the enemy's tank?
This is the next question, isn't it? So if the Russians aren't using them, surely they're going to lose these tank battles.
Well, that's right, and they have, haven't they? That's the point. When there was the first period when there were tank battles, the Russians did lose a lot of tanks. And in fact, I've seen a picture. I've got a photograph which I took from a video. I sliced it out of a video in Latvia, because what they're doing is they're taking these tanks and putting them in the square, in the town square in Tallinn and in Riga and in Poland and places where they don't like the Russians. And they're sort of saying, hey, look, we've blown up this Russian tank and here it is. But one of the pictures that I saw, one of the videos I saw, showed this Russian tank with people standing and throwing flowers at it, incidentally, which pissed them off a lot, the local, because in the Baltic states, they don't like the Russians at all. Anyway, the tank is there and it's got a hole in the turret, which looks exactly like a depleted uranium hole. But I can't say it is one because it could have been tungsten that punched its way through. So the answer is yes. I mean, it seems to me unlikely that they didn't use it. And it also, to be honest with you, seems to me unlikely that the Russians don't use it either. But they say they don't.
What about this woman, Alice, going back to her, who for years and years was campaigning to stop X-rays of pregnant women? We had an interview with a woman, Margaret Heffernan, who wrote a book called Willful Blindness about this, saying that, well, actually, even though the facts were there in front of the medical profession back in the 1960s, still people refused to change the procedures and pregnant women were being X-rayed and those little fetuses were being damaged by those X-rays, even though the facts were out there. So I wonder what you make of this whole idea of people just almost like not wanting to know.
Well, it's more than that. It's actual pressure on doctors, and it's the introduction of crooked doctors into the system in order to head off any argument that there's a problem. I mean, one of the most crooked doctors of all. Actually, I knew Alice Stewart. She was the first chair of our European Committee on Radiation Risk. So I got her to stand as a chair for that. But then she died before we really published our first report. She was hounded out of Oxford, and she was attacked by more or less everybody. But it was a concerted attack by people who were paid to attack her. I mean, just like Monbiot, it was one of those. It was an early version of it. So there were various people who, and the man who particularly attacked her was a man called Sir Richard Doll, and he was also the man. He was a very famous epidemiologist. He was associated with the work that was involved in identifying tobacco as a cause of lung cancer. So he became quite important. And he stood out against her and said that she was nuts and so forth, and had hounded her out of the University of Oxford. There's a book by Gail Green called The Woman Who Knew Too Much about all of this. And Alice told me all about it herself. We got on really well. You know, I mean, I think she rather thought that I was a bit of an irk, but I think she quite liked me. And so, I mean, I was friendly with her and also Rosalie Bertell. And Alice was squeezed out by a concerted effort by the dark forces, the nuclear military complex. Because at that time, there was a lot of concern about weapons fallout, what I've been talking about the atomic testing in the atmosphere by both the British and the United States, and of course the Russians too. So all this stuff like strontium 90 was coming down, and nobody wanted to know that small doses from X-rays, and it was only like a very small dose, 10 millisieverts, could cause a 40% increase in childhood cancer. So everyone said, no, no, it's not possible, it's not possible, and particularly Sir Richard Doll. Later on, Sir Richard Doll, after he died, it turned out he was working for the enemy. He was paid money by Monsanto to make all sorts of pony epidemiological positions, you know, to take various phony epidemiological positions about GM foods and so forth. So he was a bad guy. He was a bad guy. And along with him, there were a lot of other bad guys as well. So, and more or less like it is now. I mean, I'm kind of the last of the Mohicans here, but they certainly ripped the hell out of poor old Alice.
Well, look, you mentioned the Green Party earlier on. The Scottish Greens are moving towards support for nuclear. Is this maybe where the Green Party's heading? I mean, here in Bristol, just for as an example, looks like the Green Party, well, they are now the largest single party on the city council. The Labour Party are in this kind of Starmer-esque meltdown with the man who helped prosecute Julian Assange and failed to prosecute Jimmy Savile as the leader of the opposition, who's not actually opposing. So the Greens seem to be on the up. What do you make of their position on nuclear now?
Well, I think it's a nightmare. I mean, if it comes to that, look at that Green Party woman. What's her name? Annalena Baerbock, you know, and her position on Putin and the Ukraine and so forth. I think the Green Party has had it. Even when I was then, I mean, there was a real Green Party in the 90s. It was what we would call a Green Party, but it was real. They were clever people and they discussed things and they figured out what the best way forward would be and all the rest of it. And they were horrifyingly anti-nuclear, naturally enough. And it started as an anti-nuclear movement in Germany with Petra Kelly, who they assassinated. So what happened when I was there, and I watched it happen, was the infiltration of the Green Party. And you must expect that to happen because the Green Party was one of the most anti-capitalist and pro-equality operations that existed at that time. And they had been doing quite well in the first European Parliament elections in 1989. So everybody was scared to death about them. And so what happened is they just infiltrated the party with a load of stooges. And I watched this all happen. I watched them slowly being pushed to the right or pushed to, you know, the direction that they have now gone pushed to. And so now, of course, we have the culmination of all of this nonsense with people like Monbiot, who was always a sleeper, and Mark Lynas and various other sort of worthies who are trying to push the idea of safe, peaceful, you know, nuclear power that will prevent global warming and save everybody and blah, blah, blah. So I have no time for the Green Party. Although I'm a member of it, but I ought to really resign and make a video about it, you know, and say what a bunch of crooks they are now.
So do you think that that we are going to see a rollout of nuclear around the UK now? I mean,
they're going to try. I mean, what their idea is to use these what they call small modular reactors. So, you know, every town has its own reactor. It's a complete absurdity, the whole business. And incidentally, I know a lot about small modular reactors because I'm doing a big court case in Scotland now over a submarine guy who died of lymphoma who was on a submarine. And I wrote a paper which was published about cancer in US Navy sailors who operated on nuclear ships, showing that they had a tenfold excess of cancer. These things are not really shielded because they're small. They have to be small, they have to be light, so they're not like the big huge ones that have enormous concrete shielding. And in particular, what they do is they leak neutrons. So they don't have a big enough shielding to keep the neutrons in the reactor, and the neutrons come out and they turn the air into carbon-14 because, you know, you've got nitrogen-14 and you can turn the air into carbon-14, and carbon-14 gets incorporated into the body just like, you know, uranium. It's an internal radionuclide and it gives you cancer because, of course, everything in your body is made of carbon. And so there are lots and lots of bits of evidence that I've now dug out, and this is another paper I'll have to produce showing that the health effects of exposure to these small modular reactors are astonishingly high. Of course, the trouble is that they can say, look at, you know, this is Chris Busby, he wears a beret, he's a nutcase, you know, and doesn't matter what he publishes in the peer-reviewed literature, it's all a load of nonsense, and hurrah, let's go forward with nuclear, which is going to save us all. Anyway, all I can do in this is to remain, so long as they don't kill me, which is also possible, given that Stuart Smith died, is to remain, a thorn in their flesh, and to in the courts now draw attention to the fact that their risk model is utterly dishonestly constructed, and it's constructed in a way that is arbitrary and capricious.
So, final question is, I mean, in 2021 there was a earthquake in Haiti. The Russians said that they believed that the Americans might have triggered that by an underground nuclear weapon. Is that feasible? I mean, we've just had a massive earthquake in Turkey, but is it possible, do you think, that these things might be triggered? I mean, there is a ban on atmospheric tests, but there's no ban on underground tests.
Well, it's certainly possible, but you would have a job. I mean, it would be technically quite complicated. That's the only thing I say. That's the first thing. And the second, because you'd have to drill down and put it down into the fault line somewhere. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that, in principle, theoretically, it would produce some sort of footprint. So anybody, if you are accusing them of doing that, and you could go along and take some measuring equipment and prove it.
So that is feasible, but unlikely. I mean, because I mean, you get all sorts of these survey, massive boreholes going down kilometers and things like that. People are out there doing this kind of thing, and with a mini nuke, it doesn't seem as if that's such an impossible thing to do.
No, it's absolutely possible. It's absolutely possible to do it. No question about it.
Chris, how do listeners follow your work? I mean, obviously, you don't use Google or DuckDuckGo or any of these corrupt search engines. Where's the best place to find you?
I have no idea. I mean, I put when I do something important, I put it on. I tell you what you can do, and this at the moment. And I was going to mention this. I mentioned it in an article that I'm writing for Counterpunch. Is that if you put in Chris Busby into Google, just Chris Busby, you will get 2,700,000 hits. Okay, but on the first page, the main man you see is a Chris Busby who's an Irish rugby referee, and you'll see a load of other various Chris Busbys, but you won't see me, or you might see me. So most of them are not Chris Busby. But if you put in Dr. Chris Busby, then you get 2,200,000 hits. So in other words, most of those 2,700,000 hits are me. So if you want to find my stuff, put in Dr. Chris Busby, and you'll find it in Google. So Google has just tries to squeeze me out, but it hasn't sort of
But
totally
yeah, but
squeezed
they're
me
going to
out.
be listening to this, Chris, and then they're going to change their algorithm.
Well, I they may not, because I've just blown the whistle on them in Counterpunch, so they may not.
Well,
But the
not
other
when
way
they
is
put that
other way
claim to
is
do
to
it,
go
yeah. They
I
tend
put
to enforce that kind of willful blindness on making sure that things don't. And they've also had Michael Tyler has been on my show explaining how he detected 2 or 3 days a few years ago where all of the alternative views were censored out of the Google search. They were trying out what he called a wartime algorithm.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I say 2,700,000 hits, that probably is only a small fraction of the real number of hits. So they've already filtered out a lot of the stuff. But the point is that I'm getting really, really, really famous. I mean, I have to say, I am.
Not in the
Because,
UK.
no, well, certainly in the UK. Certainly on the media circus, anyway. And also in the scientific community. I mean, I've had 4,700 citations of my work. So in terms of the peer review literature and that sort of end of things, well, anyway, I won't go on
Well,
about
I
it.
mean,
But you can.
in what parts of the world do you think your work is most read, your scientific work?
America. Anyway, the thing is, I put most of my stuff on green audit websites, so I'm not very good at it, and I ought to get better with it. I'm going to sort of increase my energy in all of this in the next few months. Okay, so I shall put all of my stuff on the green audit website, www.greenaudit.org. And also on my Twitter, I put if I do something significant and interesting, I put it on Twitter. So, at Christo Busby, and so, but I really must sort of. The trouble is, Tony, I spend so much time doing the research, I find it utterly boring and tedious and irritating having to deal with all of this media stuff, you
Yeah,
know.
I mean,
So.
if we had a decent press, Chris, they'd be picking up on this stuff and spreading it around the planet, but obviously we don't. Anyway, look, Dr. Chris Busby, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, Tony, cheers.